This is the Alan McRae Lecture in Isaiah, chapters 1 to 6, lecture number 7. Alan McRae was president of Biblical Theological Seminary, and these lectures were given in 1976. Beginning lecture number 7, Dr. McRae speaks of the exam that he is giving the students. And although you, dear listener, do not have to take the exam, of course, you may be interested in one of his questions, because it asks one to compare Isaiah chapter 4 with Micah chapter 4. And that would be a good exercise just to see if you, after listening to all that has been said, can make the comparison between the chapters. So here I begin. Now I would like you to be sure that everyone is in the right seat, because I have one set of tests for the odd-numbered seats and one for the even-numbered seats. So you won't be distracted by whatever anybody is writing next to you. I will give these out, but I will tell you the first question so you can start immediately. The first question for students in odd number seats is to discuss Isaiah chapter 4, verse 1. The first for an even numbered seat is to discuss Micah chapter 4, verse 1. You see, it's 4-1 in both cases, but for even numbered seats, it's 4-1 in Micah. For odd-numbered seats, it is 4-1 in Isaiah. And now I'll give you the rest of the questions. Now, here's the regular lecture. Now, as you see by the outline on the board, we are ready for Roman numeral number 7. Quote, Isaiah's call to service, end quote, which is the 6th chapter of Isaiah. Thus far, we have noticed that most of the material goes under one of two headings. It is either rebuke for sin and declaration of coming punishment, or else it is comfort for the godly with promises of future blessing. Most everything thus far can be put under a heading of rebuke or blessing. Now, this 6th chapter is hard to put under either heading because it involves very great blessing for Isaiah, but it involves a very great rebuke for the people as a whole. It really then should go under a different category. There is much discussion as to whether this is Isaiah's original call for service or whether it is a renewed call given later in his ministry. It's a rather silly thing to spend time arguing about this because there is absolutely no way that we can decide what it is. If it was given in the first chapter of Isaiah, as we have Jeremiah's call in the first chapter of Jeremiah, and Ezekiel's call in the first chapter of Ezekiel, no one would question whether this is Isaiah's original call for service. As you read it, it certainly sounds like an original call for service. I think myself it's a good guess that it is. But one cannot rule out the possibility that after Isaiah had been serving the Lord for some time, he had a renewed call, which is described in this chapter. The first 6 chapters of Isaiah, which we call part 1 of our course, of this particular course that is, are actually part 1 of the book of Isaiah. There's a sharp division between the end of chapter 6 and the beginning of chapter 7. Chapters 7 through 12 form a very definite unit separate from these in the first 6 chapters. I think a good argument can be made for these first 6 chapters being a sort of summary of a great part of Isaiah's mission, possibly written during his ministry or towards the end of it, but placed at the beginning as a very proper introduction for the whole of his book. The last chapter then in this section, which I am calling Roman numeral 7, or quote, Isaiah's call for service, end quote, is one which I am not going to divide up by means of an outline. The divisions are quite obvious. It is a definite account of a series of events, and we will look at these events and look at certain features about them. I don't think there is much to put on the board about it. It is one of the finest chapters in the book of Isaiah from the viewpoint of preaching. One time in the seminary, we arranged to have this chapter be the subject of maybe a dozen continuous chapel messages, looking at various aspects of it. It is full of spiritual meaning. It is a tremendously vital chapter for every Christian, I would say. But a great part of the lesson is quite obvious. There are comparatively few problems in this chapter that we need to go through in class in any detail, though I do think we should take time to emphasize its great value in the Scripture as a whole and its great importance in your preaching and in your studies as a student. Now, the chapter I put up there, hopefully, you can see it. The screen doesn't seem to be quite as straight as usual, however, but as I said, I don't care what version of the Scripture you use in this class. Any version at all, in any language, is fine. But if you use something other than the three most used Bibles among conservatives today, that is, the King James Version, the New American Standard Bible, and the New International Version, or NIV, or even if you use another one, or even if you use one of these Bibles, or if any different Bible you are using, you have something that reads differently in the ones that we are using in class, then I wish you would call our attention to it. It adds to the value of the course if some are comparing other versions of the Bible. Now, let's begin with a strange statement in this chapter 6. Quote, "In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord," end quote. Why didn't he just say 732 BC, "I saw the Lord"? That would seem much more reasonable, wouldn't it? A much easier way to keep track of the years, wouldn't it? But it is a strange thing that this system that we have of calling years by numbers, that is, number of years after the birth of Christ, only originated about 400 years after the time of Christ. Before that time, there was one nation which got into the habit of using a numerical system to keep track of years, and that was the nation of Syria, where Seleucus, one of Alexander the Great's generals, had secured the largest portion of Alexander's empire after Alexander's death. And Seleucus had been in control in Babylon for a brief time as governor, but then he was driven out, and he took service with Ptolemy, who was king of Egypt. And then he came back with Ptolemy's help to Babylon and reestablished himself there. He did this in 312 BC, and for some reason, they started numbering years in that region from the year when Seleucus came back to Syria, and that's the oldest known system of continuous numbers. That system was continued so long that in a Hebrew manuscript of the Old Testament, written, say, around 1000 AD, you will have the year often given as such and such a year of the Seleucid era. So it is so many years after 312 BC when you see that number, when Seleucus went to Babylon. But the worst of it is that often in making those manuscripts 100 years seem so long that people wouldn't bother to put down the century. They would just say, quote, "written in the year 54, end quote, and you didn't know whether it was 1454 or 1354 or 1254 years after Seleucus went to Babylon. But that is the first time that numbers were used in this way to keep track of years. In Egypt, they would often number by the reign of kings, and also, as you know from the Old Testament, would say, in such and such a reign of such a king, and then you had a king like Uzziah, who was stricken with leprosy and had to turn over everything to his son Jotham, but we don't know what year it was that that happened. Someone might say an event took place in the 13th year of Uzziah, who reigned 52 years, and someone else might say, well, it was the 6th year of Jotham. It might be the same year. Now, in Assyria, they named the years after particular officials. That is, the first year was named after the king, the second year was named after the leading minister, and so on. And if the king reigned, let's say, 40 years, they got down to fairly unimportant officials when naming the years, getting a different man as the man for the name of the year. In Rome, they named years after the consuls, and you can see this became very complicated. The Seleucid era perhaps gave the idea to the monk named Dionysius, sometime in the 5th century, to name years from Christ's birth. He estimated when Christ was born. Dionysius thought that it was the 467th year after Christ was born. And then on, we, using BC and AD, base our BC AD dates on the work of Dionysius. But he was somewhere between 4 and 6 years off by miscalculation. So our years are off by a few years, but he has given us a wonderfully convenient system to keep track of years. So Isaiah said, in the year that Uzziah died is when he saw his vision. But when he mentioned it this way, most interpreters think that he is not merely calling our attention to the time when this happened. And incidentally, the time when it happened doesn't tell us whether this is the beginning of Isaiah's ministry or not. Rather, Isaiah ministered in the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah. And if his call came the year King Uzziah died, that could be enough to justify putting Uzziah in with the other three kings, giving a very long period of time for Isaiah's ministry. But that doesn't prove whether this is his original call or a later call. But most interpreters think that his mentioning Uzziah's death is not merely a means of saying when this vision came, but it also points to the background of the general situation in which he is prophesying. Uzziah had begun as a very godly king, a man who desired to do the will of God and a man whom God blessed. But as he succeeded in reigning as a very good and successful king for a time, the situation went to his head, as it does often when a person is in a position of authority or a position of real power, and he begins to consider himself as of greater importance than he is and decides to take over control of the religious aspect of the nation. Theoretically, that is true even today in England. For example, in England today, the Queen of England is, according to her official title, the head of the Church of England, and theoretically, no one can ascend to any position in the Church of England today except as the Queen appoints him. Actually, the Church makes most of its decisions on its own, but the Prime Minister may change it and put in whoever he wants in any position in the Church of England. The Prime Minister really controls, but that is done in the name of the Queen. And that was forbidden in the Old Testament. The rulers were civil rulers. They were supposed to protect the religious authority, but they themselves were not to assume leadership or make determinations in lieu of the religious authorities in this matter. That was a distinctly separate matter, and legally church and state should be separate. That was one of Calvin's great stands. It was that the church and state would be separate. And even though the leaders in the church in Geneva during this time were appointed from the council that were elected by the people as a political election, and thus the state had great authority over the religious matters, Calvin didn't like that, but there was nothing he could do about it. Yet Calvin insisted that the minister, along with those men who were leaders and in control of the church, that they should not be interfered with by the civil authority. Luther took the opposite attitude of that, and Luther said, quote, "What do we care who runs the church? Let the bishops keep on running it, just so they preach the gospel," end quote. And in other words, the bishops at this time were not teaching the gospel, and there was no way to make them do it. So in Denmark, for example, he began appointing new members to the clergy who would preach the gospel, while in Sweden, the king appointed them, and eventually the situation had changed. But it remained in the Lutheran country that the state controlled the church. And to some extent, it remains that way today in Germany and in the Scandinavian countries. But getting back to the Old Testament, this interference of the state with religious authorities was forbidden. And so King Uzziah, when he went beyond his authority as king and decided he would take over the religious life, and went right into the temple and began to offer incense, which only the priest was supposed to do. We read in the books of Kings and Chronicles how the priests came in and rebuked Uzziah for his offering incense, and then he looked at him And lo and behold, Uzziah's face had broken out in leprosy. Oh, how he hated the fact that God punished him this way. So his face broke out with leprosy, and we read that he lived in his own house alone for the rest of his life. And how long that was, whether that was 40 years or 10 years or the like, we really don't know. But it would seem likely that Isaiah would pass by the palace where Uzziah lived alone. Nobody dared to go near the palace for fear of catching leprosy, which everybody feared as a terrible disease. But as Isaiah would pass, and perhaps even see Uzziah's face at the window, it would suggest to Isaiah the wonderful start that this man made, as he seemed to be such a wonderful man, so true in following the Lord, and then the way in which he departed from the Lord, and the terrible way in which the Lord punished him. And so it is thought by most interpreters that Isaiah says this not merely to tell us when his vision came to him, but to show something of the background in Isaiah's mind when it happened. There would be a tragic feeling that he would have to think of one who started out so wonderfully and who failed so miserably. When you look back, as I can, on a good many years of friends and Christian workers, one cannot avoid sometimes having similar feelings as you think of individuals who have started out and done wonderfully in the Lord and then have fallen by the wayside. And it is truly amazing the number of terribly wonderful Christian leaders who have fallen into sin of one sort or another and then fallen away. It is an awful, very shocking thing when we hear of individuals like this. And so Isaiah has in mind a situation in which he was very conscious of the tragedy that is so common in human life, for he saw it in King Uzziah with his own eyes. Whether this vision came after Uzziah died or shortly before, as I said, we don't know, but at least Uzziah in this vision was very much in Isaiah's mind. Now Isaiah says that he saw the Lord sitting upon the throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. Now where was Isaiah when he had the vision? It immediately suggests that he was in the temple, and saw this in the temple. Certainly the temple is called God's house. God speaks of the temple as a place where he would dwell. But he dwelt above the mercy seat, and the mercy seat was in the Holy of Holies, where people could not reach him. Only the high priest could reach him, and that was once a year. And consequently, we are not at all sure whether he is referring to the earthly temple. Some claim that Isaiah, like Paul later on, was taken up to heaven for 3 days. Paul says he saw things that were not lawful for a man to utter. It does not tell us of his experience during those 3 days, but Paul had a marvelous experience, although we don't know how much that experience entered into his epistles and into his work with God. But here we have Isaiah giving his account of his experience. We often find the prophet had a great vision of God, but did he have this vision in the temple? Or in the vision, did he see a temple and imagine himself in it? And if so, was it the earthly temple, or was it what the temple stood for? Was he lifted up to heaven? Did he see this in heaven? Did he see God in an imaginary form? Because God, after all, does not have human form. No man has seen God, but Isaiah saw something that represented God to him, and it was marvelous. There's no mention of a face, or of arms, or of other human features. Here it is the train of his robe that Isaiah saw. It is the manifestation of God that filled the temple, where Isaiah was, or which Isaiah saw, whichever it was. And above this train stood the seraphim. Now, this word seraph, which is the singular of seraphim, appears only in this chapter, nowhere else in the Bible. The word, which seems to be related to the verb that means to burn, sometimes has been translated by people as, quote, the burning ones, end quote. Evidently, they would be messengers of God. Perhaps we could call them angels of some sort. At least they would be individuals who would be so bright that they would seem to be burning. They were God's emissaries in this vision of Isaiah. We do not have this word seraph anywhere else except as it occurs in this chapter. Now, in the Bible, we also have the word cherubim, which is the plural of cherub, if you please, and by a most peculiar thing, as developed today, cherub has come to mean a little child, perhaps even with little wings. And we have pictures of cute little children, or usually you speak of somebody as having this cherubic countenance, but actually the cherub seems to have been looking more like an ox rather than like a human being in the Old Testament period. And the cherub is mentioned much more than the seraph in the scriptures. But these two are mentioned simply as a reminder to us that in the spiritual world there is much that we do not know about. The material world today is known to have all sorts of things in it that people never dreamed of 100 years ago. There are forces in the material world that scientists have discovered that 100 years ago were absolutely undreamed of, absolutely unknown, that are today referred to often in common ways. The great import is this. Take something like electricity that is so important in the lives of all of us, and 300 years ago, nobody even dreamed of it. The idea that you could pick up a telephone and dial something and it rings a bell thousands of miles away, nobody would have imagined it. So if the material world is so far beyond what we could have imagined, just think of the spiritual world, what that must be like. God has revealed certain things about it in the scriptures, but there's an awful lot that we don't know about it, and this is all we know about the seraphim, is what we find here in Isaiah chapter 6. But we do know they were messengers of God, they were instruments to do His will. And He gives this peculiar description of the seraphim, quote, "Each one had 6 wings, with 2 he covered his face, with 2 of them he covered his feet, and with 2 of them he could fly," end quote. He only needed 2 wings to fly, but he had 6. God provides for the needs of His servants. He gives us far more than we need to accomplish His will, and it's the covering of the face before the majesty of God that's implied here. And yet, we have an intimate view of God. We know Jesus as we know our best friend, and yet we must always know that He is so great and so wonderful beyond what we can imagine, such that we should show Him reverence, just as even the seraphim did by covering their faces in the presence of the Lord. And one seraph cried to the other and said, quote, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of His glory," end quote. This statement, quote, "is full of His glory," end quote, is not an exact translation. The Hebrew word full is male, but the word here is malo. You see the difference, male versus malo. In the same root, it's the same root, but it is a noun rather than an adjective. Literally, what Isaiah wrote should be translated as, quote, "The fullness of the whole earth is His glory," end quote. Well, everybody that I have looked into, every commentator that is, and the varied sources that I have looked up, usually translate it this way, quote, "The whole earth is full of His glory," end quote. But I can't escape the feeling that it might be a little more literal to say, quote, "The fullness of the whole earth is His glory," end quote. In other words, that all of the wonderful things that we know of in this world and all the wonderful things that are in the universe that God has made that we don't know about or can't see, they are all part of God's glory. Now that is to say that I have not found anybody else who expresses that thought, but it does seem to me that that would be a more literal translation of the Hebrew. And there are plenty of places in the Bible that make us think that the earth is all God's glory. I can't help thinking of all the marvelous universe that is just part of the wonderful glory of God who created it all. Now, getting back to the vision, the posts of the doors, or more literally, the foundation of the walls, moved at the voice of Him who cried on the throne. As the seraphim cries, the whole place shook. We read in Acts how when God spoke to the people that the building shook, or at least that is what they were feeling. The feeling of Isaiah was that this mighty force of God, like people have in the midst of an earthquake, that the world seems to just shake, and you feel how puny, how small is humanity and all of its people compared to the tremendous force of nature, and God, of course, is far greater than any of this. Though I think we should take a look further into the chapter next week, because I didn't mention the assignment till I met with you in the beginning, let me take a second to do that. This is what we want to do. It is not a long assignment. This time, you have already looked at chapters 56 and 57 and noted in them what parts were rebuke and what parts were blessing. All I'm asking is that you do the following. Look over chapters 58 and 59 and divide them in the way that we did before. That is, what passages are rebuke and what passages are blessing, and what is there in there in these chapters that you don't think really belongs under either category of rebuke and blessing. And if you find such a passage, please suggest another category for it. This is really a brief assignment, but please turn it in by next Friday. This ends lecture number 7 by Alan McRae.